The next matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Alexander Jonas. And you can correct me whether I'm pronouncing it correctly. Is it Jonas or Jonas?
It's Jonas.
Jonas, thank you. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, please be mindful of the timing restrictions, which are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to match your height for your convenience. There's a button in front. We keep only an audio recording of the proceedings, so please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're situated and ready to go, you have the floor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Scanlon, and I represent appellant Alexander Jonas. We are asking this court to order a hearing on Mr. Jonas's post-conviction petition, and we are asking this court to vacate his conviction for kidnapping. I am most eager to address the issues that members of this panel find dispositive on either of those issues. I do want to begin briefly with a few comments about the kidnapping issue. If we credit LS's own account, this encounter was sexual from the very beginning. He was aggressive at the bar. He was aggressive in the parking lot of the bar. As soon as they got in the house, he was trying to remove her clothing. Again, this is her account. And then they both ended up downstairs. Nothing that happened downstairs. There wasn't any kidnapping conduct downstairs that wasn't also then related to this, to the sexual activity that happened there. Again, according to her account. So he hadn't removed her from the bar. He didn't remove her from the parking lot to the house. He didn't remove her from down to the basement. What happened in the basement was either confining her or somehow adjusting her position for the purpose of accomplishing sexual acts. He tied her wrists. He pinned her down with her knees. Again, this is LS's account. He grabbed her by her arms and jerked her this way or that way, while her arms were behind her back. These acts are not criminally significant, as that phrase is used in Smith and Welch.
Well, these are acts that Welch talk about conduct that's merely incidental. Or completely incidental. Here, the tying of the hands was not momentary like the blocking of the door in Smith. If you read the transcript, I think it's clear, and I mean, you're familiar with the transcript, I think it's clear that he removed some of her clothing. She was trying to stop it, pushing his hands. He then tied her hands behind her back and then ripped off some of her clothing and then penetrated her, and she tried to get away but wasn't able to. He also, after her hands were tied, he, according to her, choked her. So her hands were tied for a period of time behind her back. It wasn't momentary. So how is this merely incidental? That's what I'm trying to understand. It seems to me that the conduct here is different than Smith and Welch, particularly when we look at the statute.
Well, so her arms being behind her back, I believe what she said was initially he was trying to hold her arms behind her back, but he couldn't, and so then he tied them with the cord. He grabbed the cord and tied the arms. That's also where she says when she would adjust her on the couch or on the floor or whatever, he was grabbing her by the upper parts of the arms, which is where bruises happen, and she said that was very painful. And she said at one point she was concerned that he was going to break her arm or rip her arms out of the socket. And so the elements of the three criminal sexual conduct charges, element of count one, force. Pain is force. And so everything that I just described, all that conduct that otherwise constitutes kidnapping, establishes that element of count one. Count two, coercion. Confinement is a way to is one of the ways you can prove coercion.
So under that theory, if someone is bound, their hands are tied for 2 hours, and they're being sexually assaulted on and off during that 2 hours, there cannot be a charge of kidnapping. Would that be your position?
Is it
your position that if someone's hands are tied after the sexual encounter starts, that there can never be a kidnapping charge along with a criminal sexual conduct charge?
I think that's what they mean by merely incidental, not otherwise criminally significant. I mean, if he confines her, ties her hands and puts her in his car and takes her somewhere, or even just confines her hand to drag her somewhere, to remove her somewhere else for this to happen. But again, also here...
Isn't there testimony that he did drag her while her hands were tied?
Well, on he repositioned her on the floor, yeah, because she said he would, like, pull her back because that was how she got... I think she said she got... Her knees were hurt because she was dragged across the carpet.
If you look at the dictionary definition of incidental from the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, incidental is of a minor, casual, or subordinate nature. So when... And I don't think the Supreme Court has clearly drawn a line for us as to when something is incidental and when it's not. And so that's why I'm asking all these questions. And
I would agree.
You can help me understand the precedent and how best to apply it here. And I will ask respondent's attorney as well. But, the Supreme Court talked about it being merely incidental. And if you look at the definition of incidental, it's minor, casual, subordinate. Here, the tying of her hands seems to fit the definition of, or the elements of kidnapping. It's confining, and then clause two, to facilitate the commission of a felony. So by tying her hands, according to Alessa's testimony, he was able to sexually penetrate her a number of times, and she was trying to get away, and then he tied her hands. He confined her by tying her hands and then penetrated her. So why doesn't that... I think it does fit the definition of facilitating the commission of a felony, but then we have this case law, and I'm trying to reconcile the two.
Yeah, and so... And I appreciate that, and I don't think it's perfectly clear. I do think that the two cases that were raised in the briefs, I raised Paget, but then there was also some discussion of, I think it's Sanchez. Sanchez is the one where he takes her from the bar. He's sort of like being aggressive with her at the bar, meets up with her outside the bar, and then drags her 200 some feet to an alley. And then she's confined, she's removed there and confined there. And I guess I'm leaning more towards an understanding of incidental as being subordinate. Because again, here, I think we'd be in a different situation if she had remained tied, her hands had remained tied the whole time. Because remember, there's a break, right? There's this weird break where the sexual activity stops. She's concerned about her cats and goes upstairs, takes the cats upstairs, gets him some water. They come back down and they chat a little bit. She's not tied up during that part. And then when he does begin the sexual activity again, by her account, he ties her up again.
There was evidence, am I correct, that she tried to crawl away at one point?
I think she describes being on the floor. I can't remember what exactly is happening at the time, but yeah, she's crawling away, and he grabs her prevents her from crawling away and pulls her so that he can do what he was doing.
So wouldn't the tying of the hands then, at least for the purpose of preventing her from escaping, indicate a separate offense of kidnapping, separate from the sex conduct, if tying her hand would prevent her or restrict her or make it more difficult for her to crawl away as she had attempted?
Well, if that's the case, then what Mr. Welch did to the woman in the park, yeah, that prevented her from escaping. That prevented her from resisting. He banged her head against, he held her down and banged her head against the sidewalk. And that was incidental to his attempt. That wasn't even an actual completed crime of criminal sexual conduct. It was an attempt. But so if anything that he does to overcome her resistance or to keep her from escaping, as you say, or crawling away, if that makes it not incidental, then Welch is wrongly decided. Then Padgett is wrongly decided.
Well, but in Welch, it was a shorter time period.
It was.
And she what? The victim in Welch wasn't bound. I mean, she was forced onto the ground repeatedly in different ways, but.
So. What? I don't know
Does that matter?
I mean, again, it's a fact intensive analysis. I think it's looking at the totality of the circumstances. I don't think the means or the manner of confinement. I mean, maybe that would go to aggravation or sentencing conclusions, or even for that matter, in a kidnapping charge. That doesn't involve criminal sexual conduct. I mean, there are things on the nature of the confinement, the extent of the removal, that all would sort of weigh in various ways. But I, when we're talking about confinement or removal, I mean, I guess if we're going to talk about degrees of either, then certainly I guess to get to Judge Ross's point about dragging her. I mean, if we're saying that that's removal, it's certainly very minimal removal. It's not taking someone from the bar and out into the alley, and so the confinement. I mean, I don't know, holding the victim, Mr. Welch, holding the woman down on the sidewalk with her baby in the stroller nearby and pounding her head on the sidewalk. Is that? Less egregious confinement than tying hands behind her back? And again, originally he was trying to, again, we said he was trying to hold her arms behind her back. Is that, if he had only resorted to that and continued doing that as opposed to tying the hands, does that, to me, that shouldn't make a difference? I don't know, it's a hard question.
The State v. Earl case, are you familiar with that case?
I don't think, that doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. It's a burglary case where the family members were tied up and then there was some attempt to steal things, among other conduct. But in that case, the tying up was found to be distinct from the burglary. Do you see that as distinguishable from this scenario?
I guess I would have to know more about the facts of that case.
Fine.
I mean I could imagine it. This will surprise no one. I could imagine it cutting either way. I do think it is very specific to the case. I mean, Padgett was an extended, and I realize that Welch was a very short interaction. Padgett was a more extended. Situation, more extended circumstances, because there was he raped her on the bed. When she got up to go to the bathroom, he raped her twice in the bathroom, raped her again on the bed later. But his acts of confining her in the bathroom for those two acts was held to be incidental and not sufficient to support a separate conviction.
That was part of the sexual assault that was occurring in the bathroom, whereas the tying of the wrist didn't occur during any actual assault.
Well, and again,
it was part of the conduct leading up to it.
My position is that the sexual behavior, the behavior that constitutes the sexual assaults, the various sexual assaults that happened, that started before any of the confinement did, and it ended after the confinement, any of the confinement ended. Anything constituting kidnapping happened throughout that course of, and it was, I mean, kind of in the two sections. Again, there was that break in the middle, but within both of those sections, again, the sexual part starts before the confinement.
So let's change the facts a little bit. I'm just trying to parse out what the rule of law would be under that distinction. So assume that Alexander Jonas tied the victim's hands a half hour before the sex assault began, and they continued to sit on the couch. It was against her will to be bound, under my hypothetical. And then after a half hour of discussing other things, he begins a sexual assault, which continues for the same period that occurred in this case and ended at the same time in the same manner as in this case. Confinement?
Yeah, I think any time there's kidnapping behavior that precedes even any inkling of criminal sexual conduct, I think I have a much, much harder argument in that case. Because it looks like that was its own thing, and then maybe he got another idea, or I didn't make this clearly enough. I think it depends on how you charge the crim sex. I don't know how you charge crim sex one based on coercion which can be established by confinement, and then argue that the confinement gets to be a separate crime. It's an element of count two here. I think that makes it harder. And you have plenty of options for charging crim sex one. And if it had all been, even if it had just been count three or count one, then at least you're kind of relying on force, which can be pain, which of course can be a lot of things that aren't, can be caused by things that aren't kidnapping conduct. Of course, I think all of the pain, even in this case, all of the pain that she talked about here was a result of the confinement. Holding her down with his knees, causing bruises, grabbing her, making her...
Is there case law that establishes that tying someone up or binding them equates to coercion, or what case would you point us to for that?
Oh, I'm just taking it from the element. The definition of coercion under the relevant criminal statute includes confinement.
Okay.
That's one of the ways. It's not the only way it can be proven. I should be clear. Confinement, and in fact, I think if I can read that, coercion, words or circumstances. Oh, wait, sorry. I'm on the wrong one. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Coercion. Words or circumstances causing fear of bodily harm, use of confinement, or superior size or strength. Any of those things. Sorry, I missed that just now. But any one of those things, confinement alone can establish coercion. That element.
Thank you. That's helpful.
I think I see my time is up.
Thank you, Tim. It doesn't appear to be any other questions from the panel, so you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carl Erickson. I'm an assistant Anoka County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. I think the court's questions directed at the kidnapping charge. That's clearly the meatier argument here, so I'll jump right into that, though of course I'm happy to answer any questions about the ineffective assistance of counsel claims as well. Judge Cochran, to your point about how do we know when conduct is completely incidental, and it's sort of a difficult line. I think the way to think about this is to look at the facts underlying the confinement for kidnapping and ask, if we took those away, would there still be a criminal sexual assault? So we look at State v. Welch, and we see in that case the defendant pushed the victim down, knelt on top of her, and then got up momentarily afterwards after she sprayed him with mace and kicked him. And the conviction there was attempted second-degree criminal sexual conduct, which is contact. It wasn't a penetration-based assault. So necessarily, he had to have physical contact with her to push her down. Presumably, she would have run away if he tried to just grope her without pushing her down. So the very conduct that was the confinement, that was pushing her down, was his attempt to have sexual contact with her. And if we look at State v. Paget, the confinement that they talk about there with regard to the kidnapping was forcing her to sit on the toilet while he forced her to perform fellatio on him and forcing her to bend over the vanity while he penetrated her anally there.
Appellant's counsel just raised a good point that one of the charges in this case was criminal sexual conduct by coercion. And coercion includes confinement. So isn't that the coercion that occurred here part of the criminal sexual conduct charge? So can you address what the coercion is here that is at issue? And does it include the binding of the wrists?
I mean, to me, for the kidnapping charge, the coercion is, or the confinement doesn't include the confining of the wrists, and the fact that that might overlap with the conversion.
So you, just so I heard you correctly, you agree that the coercion includes the confinement of being bound by the wrists?
I think that it can go to that, but I don't think that means that it can't also support the kidnapping charge. Because if you remove the binding of the wrists, there would still be first-degree criminal sexual conduct here. That was not something that was like Paget putting the victim's body in a particular position that was like physically necessary on like an anatomical level to accomplish the criminal sexual assault.
Well, what other coercion occurred here that could be separate from the binding?
There was the holding her down. She testified that Mr. Jonas knelt on her legs. He testified that he pulled her back, both like pulling on her clothes, trying to bring her back, and yanking her around by the tied cords. She testified that as soon as they got in the house, he started trying to pull her clothes off. And aside from physical confinement, there was also an emotional aspect to this. She testified that Mr. Jonas had kicked her hard between the legs, and she was scared that if she resisted what he wanted to do, that he would kick her again and he would potentially hurt her, break bones, maybe break her back, and she wouldn't be able to escape at all. And
this would seem to be a really difficult case for the state if there was no binding involved and Alexander Jonas, instead of using the cord, held the victim's arms behind her back for the duration of the sex offense. So would you agree with that?
I would agree it would be more difficult, but I don't think it would fail for that reason, because holding her hands behind her back, again, is different than just compelling someone to be in a particular position.
So holding someone down while you're committing a sex offense, that's kidnapping?
I think that can be, yes. I agree that would be a...
But doesn't Welch say that that is not kidnapping? I mean, Welch talks about... In Welch, the individual was thrown to the ground and then He straddled her. He slammed her hand against the ground in an attempt to force her to drop the mace. He slammed her head against the ground. And the court said that, I'm just scrolling down, that the confinement that forms the basis of kidnapping is the very force and coercion that supports the attempted second-degree criminal sexual conduct conviction. If such incidental conduct can support a kidnapping conviction, well, basically the court goes on to say that that doesn't support a kidnapping conviction because it was part of the criminal sexual conduct attempt.
So I guess I'd respond to that in two ways. First, I think the question is not whether the confinement could support kidnapping. I think implicit in the analysis is that the confinement does support a kidnapping charge. The question is whether there's such complete overlap between the confinement for kidnapping and the confinement for the underlying charged offense, crim sex in this case, that it unduly exaggerates the criminality of
right,
the conduct.
Right, and that goes to my question, back to my question, which is, and I framed it wrong by asking you whether it would support kidnapping. Would it support a kidnapping frame separate from the crim sex if what happened here, same conduct, except instead of using a cord to bind, Alexander Jonas used his physical force to hold her hands in place?
I think that would definitely be a closer case if he didn't use the cord, but I think there would still be confinement in that case because holding her hands behind
there would be confinement, but would it be confinement allowing a separate kidnapping offense? I think in a lot of cases, what we're talking, a lot of these hypotheticals, confinement would occur, but that's not the issue. As you've pointed out, that's not really the issue we're talking about.
I think that it would depend on the facts of that case. Like, how hard was the victim being held by their hands? Was there any other conduct?
No, exactly as this case. The hypothetical is exactly what occurred in this case, but instead of using the cord, Jonas used his hands and held her wrists in place exactly for the same duration and with the same extent of confinement as occurred with the cords. Wouldn't it be impossible for the state to argue, have a viable argument that that's anything more than crim sex?
I think if we're just looking at the binding versus the him holding her down, I think at the very least it would be a difficult case to prove. But in this case, there's more than just the cord binding her, which I think I didn't quite get to earlier. But I would argue, or I would say that there is confinement here based on the psychological coercion, that she was afraid of what he was going to do to her because of the kicking. And the kidnapping statute, it just requires confinement. It doesn't require force to do it.
My hypothetical includes all of that. My hypothetical includes everything happening exactly as it occurred in this case. The only difference is the holding. Even with this, you know, the coercion, the threats, I mean, those occur, I mean, sad to say, they occur in crim sex cases, forced intercourse cases all the time. So I'm struggling to see how it would be the state could argue without the binding here that you'd have a basis for a separate kidnapping charge. And if that's so, I'm trying to understand why the distinction would matter, the fact that there's a cord versus hands.
I think On the facts of this case, just with the cord removed, I think I would point to State v. Butterfield as the reason why there would still be a kidnapping charge. I mean, in that case, the conduct was significantly more egregious. It lasted a lot longer. It was just a terrible case. But the court, when it addressed whether kidnapping was completely incidental to the criminal sexual conduct, it focused on the fact that there were breaks in the criminal sexual conduct when the victim wasn't bound, she wasn't locked in a house, but she was still confined for purposes of kidnapping because she was afraid of what the defendant in that case would do if she tried to leave. And in this case, there's a similar gap. Again, it's shorter, but there's this gap between the first sexual assault conduct, and then there's this gap where they're laying on the couch, she's not tied up, but in that time period, she's still afraid of what Mr. Jonas is going to do if she tries to leave or tries to resist. So I think in that gap, she is still being confined for kidnapping purposes, and that's without the tying of the hands with the cord, without holding her hands, without any other of the force that would normally kind of obviously go to kidnapping.
Was there any actus reus during that period in support of the kidnapping, during this gap? Did he say anything that would indicate confinement or coercion, or was it just the victim's continued fear from the earlier segment of the assault?
No, I don't think that there's anything in the record, or at least nothing that I am aware of off the top of my head, of any threats that he made in that period. It's just the implied threat based on his behavior up to that point. And the victim testified that she was afraid of what he would do to him. So she did testify that she was experiencing that fear and felt confined. But no, there was no words that he spoke during that time saying, if you leave, I'm going to hurt you, or something like that.
Since we all seem to be struggling with how this standard applies in this circumstance, what would the rule of law be? Assume that we issued a precedential opinion. What would the rule of law be that we would draw from this case that would provide guidance to prosecutors and district courts?
I think it's difficult to have a bright line rule in this, because the analysis of what actual conduct happened is so fact specific, and like what conduct is completely incidental, it's difficult to draw a bright line on that. So I think I would say again,
there has to be some rule of law that helps us to understand why this is or is not incidental.
I think the test would be, is there conduct that constitutes confinement that if you take that away, there is still criminal sexual assault? So in this case, if you take away the binding of the wrists, there is still the underlying felony of criminal sexual assault. In Welch, if you took away the holding her down, there's no physical contact, so then the underlying attempted second-degree criminal sexual assault charge would fail, because there's no attempt to make that contact.
But in Smith, if you took away the incidental conduct, which was blocking a door, the murder still happened. I mean, the blocking of the door was not part of the murder.
I think.
In other words, I'm not sure the standard you're asking us to apply would stand up under the analysis that the Supreme Court undertook in Smith. But help me understand if you disagree.
I think Smith is a little bit different because it isn't a sexual assault case, so there's not the level of physical contact necessary in a murder that there is in a criminal sexual conduct case. So that distinguishes it. And I think in Smith, if you took away that confinement, then the murder as the underlying felony likely wouldn't have happened, because the person would have been able to escape the room. And I agree, like, it's not a perfect fit. I would agree with that. I don't know that there's a perfect way to reconcile Smith. And I think part of that is the result of Smith being a murder and assault as the underlying felonies versus crim sex, which are just factually different, as I stated, because of the requirements for physical contact.
So your argument, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that the finding of the wrist, the confinement here, was not incidental to the criminal sexual conduct charges, because she, Jonas could have still been found guilty of the criminal sexual conduct charges absent the binding of the wrist, without considering that, the binding.
Yes, that's correct.
And you argue that even with regard to the coercion, criminal sexual conduct by coercion charge?
Yes.
Involving coercion?
Yeah, yes, I do think so. And I think maybe to put a little bit finer point on that is, and I note that you brought up State v. Earl, and say that's right on point, because they talk about like whether the conduct facilitates the crime, it isn't necessarily completely incidental to it. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Just briefly.
I guess just to follow up on the conversation, the question about what the rule of law is, I'm not sure this is exactly a rule of law, but on page 32 of my brief, I do kind of summarize two of what I call the salient considerations that are central to the court's analysis in Smith and Welch: the timing of the kidnapping conduct and the nature of the conduct establishing the underlying offense. That latter part is kind of my idea about, look, if it's an element of the kidnapping or of the robbery or the whatever, if it's an element of the other offense, then that makes it, that means it's more likely to be incidental. Maybe that means it's incidental. And at least that would be clear direction, that because then if you also want to charge kidnapping, don't charge crim sex count, don't rely on a crim sex subdivision that would make that kidnapping conduct satisfy an element. I hope I'm not making that too confusing, but go ahead.
I think I understand your point. Given that point, can you respond to respondent's argument that there was coercion even without the binding of the wrists?
Well, I think that's problematic because, yeah, there are different ways to establish coercion, but we don't know what the jury relied on. I mean, I suppose you could, you're the prosecutor. You have some discretion. You can propose a jury instruction that leaves the confinement out of the coercion definition of count two or whatever. And then there's no doubt, right? Or at least we know that the jury found coercion not in reliance on the kidnapping conduct. I guess that would be my nuance to what I'm proposing kind of as the rule. I also think that this timing is important. I don't want to make it a rule. Like, I don't think the rule is if the kidnapping conduct happens before there's any sexual conduct. I'm not phrasing this well, but you get the idea. If somehow the kidnapping, it's happening within all of the sexually criminal conduct. When it happens in that range, and again, the way I put it is that certainly makes it less incidental. It's happening at the same time. It wasn't before, it wasn't after. The only other thing I did want to address briefly, I did just want to say a word about the ineffective assistance of counsel. And I know this is hard, and I know that I'm kind of up against it because we defer to what we presume to be reasonably strategic choices that counsel makes. And here's what I'm going to say about that. And I'm going to rely on Justice G. Barry Anderson concurring in State v. Rhodes, that's 6578 Northwest 2nd 823 from 2003. We will generally resist the temptation to question the countless tactical decisions defense counsel makes, quote, so long as defense counsel's performance preserves a truly adversarial contest between the prosecution and the defendant. When defense counsel's actions or inaction, quote, cannot be explained by any reasonably conceivable strategy, our customary deference must cede to our duty to protect a defendant's right to counsel. So this is what I'm saying. If this court is going to say that not cross-examining, not raising this suppression issue, but particularly the cross-examination, this court is going to say that the cross-examination of the victim in this case was a reasonable strategy, that you're deferring to that reasonable strategy. I think what Justice Anderson is saying, and I think what the case law really says, is we can't defer to a counsel's strategy as reasonable without articulating what that strategy is. We can't just say, oh, there was some hypothetical strategy here. Look, it's too hard to cross-examine criminal sexual conduct victims. And every public defender, every defense attorney out there would love an excuse to not do it. And so we have to give them some guidance. We have to say what was the reasonable strategy here? My position is, of course, we don't know. That's why we need a hearing. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Very difficult case, difficult facts, circumstances. We're mindful of that, but we will issue our opinion based on the law. Matter is submitted. Thank you for your briefing and your oral argument. Very well done, both of you. We do appreciate that. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Matter is submitted. Thank you.